I'm ready.
Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday morning, April 22nd, 2024, and we continue our podcast series on the SEAT Working Paper series. Today we are at number 14, talking about revenue neutrality, and the title of this paper is Revenue Neutrality Makes No Sense. And that title may not make a lot of sense without some context, which we'll get to in a minute. But as you might expect, I'm joined by Karen Alpert in Australia and Laura Snyder in Paris. How is everybody doing today? Karen, how are you?
Oh, it's been a gorgeous day today. Getting dark now, but
Dark. Actually, the sun's just coming up here. And Laura, what's happening in Paris? Sun's been up for a while.
another cold, cloudy day.
I love that kind of weather. You make it sound like there's something wrong with that. Are you unhappy with the weather?
4 months of cold and cloud, John.
Come on, Laura. Stay positive. All right. Well, so Laura, this is number 14 of your 16 paper collection. And I think we have actually written before collectively as SEAT on the revenue neutrality issue, haven't we?
This
Yeah.
is the second of three articles on revenue neutrality. The three of us did an article, what, 2, 3 years ago about, should Americans be required to buy their freedom, is what we called it. We have this working paper that we put online last year, and I've just had recently published in the Hofstra Law Review another article about revenue neutrality, which I'm going to post on SSRN in a few days.
All
So
right. Well,
this.
that kind of confirms that it's a significant issue. Maybe one of you could frame the issue. What does revenue neutrality even mean, and why does it matter?
Karen, I'm happy to do it, or you go ahead.
Okay. Revenue neutrality is basically the idea that when Congress changes a law, that, a tax law in particular, but any law, that's going to be a effects on the federal budget. There's going to be, a tax cut is going to lose revenue, and increasing taxes is going to raise revenue. And so there are rules that the Congress has set for itself to try and balance the budget, so, or keep it balanced, which is a, losing cause. But anyways, they've got rules set that some certain legislation has to be revenue neutral. And by that they mean that anything that it adds to the deficit by giving tax breaks has to be subtracted from the deficit by taxing it away, so that when you add all the pluses and minuses together, the whole bill has zero net effect on the federal budget.
And Karen, that's the reason generally for what are called revenue offsets in legislation, right?
Right.
So in
So
other
it's
words,
revenue to pay for whatever program they want to do.
right, so they put together this huge bill, and then at the end of the bill, there's a section called revenue offsets. And the revenue offsets might include other laws, other changes to add revenue. Would that be a fair
Yeah.
statement?
Yeah, and one of the more famous ones of these was FATCA, right? It was supposed to bring
Minute.
in how many billions of revenue?
Unbelievable. Did you know that, Laura?
I did know that. And this paper talks about that. And it also talks about some other specific examples of that. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, and HEROES, Earnings Assistance and Relief Tax Act of 2008. They were adopted, each of those adopted a revenue offset or revenue provision that expanded tax penalties in the event of expatriation. So,
Well, that's
basically.
right. So to put it in people talk for listeners, so the exit taxes, these things that make you pay up and confiscate your assets if you want to renounce U.S. citizenship, were in fact revenue offset provisions, right? Designed to finance other pieces of legislation, fair savings.
Basically, yeah, they want Congress is looking to adopt provisions that are meant to benefit people who live in the United States in some way, and particularly here through insurance and through trying to boost employment, and so giving so tax advantages to employers, for example. Also, well, gosh, also to improve service transportation. And in each case, they're looking for some way, they're looking for a pay for it, a way to pay for it, which is a little bit crazy because the federal government can make all the money it wants. It doesn't need to look to other people for money, but apparently everybody thinks that they do. And so instead of penalizing Americans who live in the United States, they look outside the United States and say, these Americans who live outside, well, they're greedy, unpatriotic, economic Benedict Arnolds. And so we're going to make the way we tax them even more penalizing.
Wow. Well, actually, my understanding of this is I cannot think of a single nasty piece of legislation aimed at Americans abroad that did not come in as a revenue offset. So not only is this nasty and evil, I mean, who reads the revenue offset provisions, right? It's a way to
Yeah,
kind
they're
of get
not part of the
the
headlines of the bill.
Well, I mean, let's look at FACA, the HIRE Act. What do you remember what that stands for?
Hiring
Hiring
incentive
incentive.
to restore employment.
That's right, exactly. That sounds noble, doesn't it?
How
And how are they going to do that?
is that at all related to hiring incentives to restore employment?
Well, I think it's related in the sense that, when you get these people who want to put together an otherwise horrible law to punish a certain group, they can't propose that as standalone legislation. They kind of look around and say, whoa, hey, I heard somebody's trying to pass a law tonight. Maybe we can add this on so nobody looks at it. What do you think?
I
Well,
think what happened.
especially if we can
Go ahead,
say,
Dan.
hey, it's going to raise money.
And especially if not only does it raise money, but guess who it raises money from, Laura? Who's it raising money from?
Ah, those of us who live outside the country.
Oh, I
I
was
think.
expecting you to say those greedy, unpatriotic
Oh,
economic
yes, the
drivers, though.
greedy. That's right. The greedy
Could
and
you
patriotic
repeat that? I
Carol
mean,
Fatt.
that rolled off your tongue so beautifully. Could you repeat that?
Well, this is what the Treasury, the Assistant Treasury Secretary said, if I recall correctly.
You mean Les Samuels?
Yes, if I recall correctly, that Americans who are renouncing citizenship were vilified as greedy, unpatriotic, malefactors of great wealth and economic Benedict Arnolds.
Yeah, it's funny. I know people who are dipping into their retirement saving to fly all around the world to renounce U.S. citizenship to get rid of this problem.
Yeah.
I think what you see, what the why this is an issue here and why, now there's we've written three articles about it, is that in to date, the proposals for trying to address the problems with the extraterritorial tax system, the nationality-based tax system, all seek to have revenue neutrality. And there are multiple problems with that. And one of the multiple problems with that is that you see, when you are insisting on revenue neutrality, you are saying we are going to have a winners and a losers group. Somebody's going to benefit from whatever, either increased spending or reduced taxation, and somebody else is going to have to pay the price for that by either be benefiting from or being hurt by reduced spending or an increase in their taxes. And so what you see with each of these examples we've just been talking about is the Congress wants to benefit somebody in the United States, and the way that they seek to do it is by basically punishing, making the losers Americans who live outside the country. And so if you take this and you say, okay, we want to fix this extraterritorial tax system, how are we going to do that? Well, the paradigm that people come to this problem with is, well, okay, if we do this, it has to be revenue neutral. Well, how do you make something revenue neutral? You have to yet again find a loser, find a victim who is going to pay the price. And when it comes to Americans living outside the country, there is nobody that can be the scapegoat like that, because we've been the scapegoats all this time. And they're not going to turn around and make somebody else the scapegoat to help with our situation. And so what you see with the proposals that are on the table today to fix this system is you see this insistence on revenue neutrality. Well, where does that money come from to compensate for whatever revenue is apparently being lost? Well, they target us back. They put it right back on us. All they do is just repackage what's happening. But make no mistake, it's yet again Americans who either live overseas or will seek to live overseas who are going to have to pay the price. And this is why there's three articles written about this, because this is a huge impediment to having real reform.
Yeah, and
Just accepting it.
one part of the problem is that they don't even know how much money citizenship taxation is raising. They don't know. Because,
Go ahead, Karen.
yeah, because first of all, the data, unless you're in the IRS itself, the data that's published publicly is not finally enough. It's not specific enough to tell what who is a non-resident citizen that would no longer be paying U.S. tax, as if they were resident. So you've got this other areas thing on the IRS website that lists the total taxes paid in other areas, but that includes military stationed overseas who would could presumably still be treated as U.S. tax residents, State Department employees overseas, and then the rest of us who are living overseas permanently. So you can't pull that out. You can't tease that out. And then even once you could tease that out, you don't know. You don't, there's not enough information to tell how much is foreign source income that the US is actually collecting tax on, which is really the only difference we have here. Because the US is still going to collect tax on US source income, possibly even at a higher rate if they apply the current rules that apply to non-resident aliens. But you'll report your foreign income all mixed in with everything else, and then you'll either use the foreign earned income exclusion or a foreign tax credit to offset it for foreign taxes. And there's no way to tease out how much different your tax bill would be on an aggregate basis for all of for everyone if the U.S. went to residence-based taxation.
There's a lot of, yes, that's a big part of the problem is how do you even know what's going on, what the situation is today, and what it would be if you did change the rules. I think it's important to keep in mind, first of all, that even though, as Karen said, there are issues with the information that's publicly available, what the publicly available information does show is that it's around six between 60 and 64% each year of returns that are filed from outside the United States that show no taxes owed. So already you see that. Oh, and if you compare how much is collected from taxpayers that have an address outside the United States compared to the federal budget, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of the
What is it,
federal
half
budget.
of a percent, something like
Something
that?
like that, yeah, something like that, and or maybe even less. And I think it's 0.5% of all income tax raised from individuals, and I think it's 0.18% of the total federal budget, or something along those lines. Anyway, multiple of our publications have those exact numbers in it. And so this demonstrates that, again, that these laws are not about collecting revenue. And members of Congress at the time each of these different laws, penalizing laws, have been adopted from the very beginning, have never said they were about collecting revenue. In each case, they've said that it is about punishing people for living over the outside the United States, discouraging them from living outside the United States, and punishing them for doing so. Never have they said it's about collecting revenue. And so it makes sense that you see that the revenue that's actually collected isn't that much in the big scheme of things. So this whole, insistence on revenue neutrality is crazy. And there's another important, I told you I said there's multiple reasons why this is a problem. Another big reason why this is a problem is because, again, what's happening here, the purpose of these rules is not to collect revenue. And what these rules do is violate people's fundamental rights. We've talked about this, in previous, in our discussions before. And, we've talked about how this violates, the right to, or, it discriminates on the basis of nationality, causes the forcible destruction of citizenship, results in second-class citizens. There's multiple other ways that I won't get into right now. And if you say to some, it makes no sense to say, we are not going to stop violating your fundamental rights unless it's revenue neutral. Because if you impose this requirement for revenue neutrality in order to rectify violations of people's rights, you're basically saying you don't have rights. We don't care about your rights. Your
Laura,
rights mean nothing compared to our want, our not need, desire to collect revenue, or at least make your life difficult. Yes, John.
so I want to ask you this, okay? I mean, first of all, let me preface this with I do agree with you, okay? But I'd like to introduce the following question. Do Americans even have rights? We talk about violating their rights. What rights? I mean, do you really believe that Americans have rights?
We have to believe that, John, because otherwise, I understand what you're trying to do, John. If we don't have rights, we're in a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble. I mean, we have to at least, are our rights actually respected? Most of the time, no, they're not. But do we inherently have those rights? Surely, if we believe in the dignity of the human being, we have to believe we have them. But whether they're respected or not is another question.
Well, you believe in the dignity of a human being. Do you think that America historically has believed in the dignity of a human being?
Even today, it still doesn't, John.
Well, then how can Americans have rights that are anything other than theoretical, I mean?
I don't have an answer to that, John.
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting question here, because, we're going to have the Moore case. Coming down probably in the next couple months, right?
Yeah.
And we all three of us, have I think spent a lot of time thinking about the Moore case, right? And one aspect of it that I think we all agree, which I mean a simple fact, right? That the Moores were individuals, and the way the whole litigation unfolded, you made the point, we've all made the point. There was no reference to individuals at all. It was all discussed in terms of the corporations, right? Agreed?
Well, for the listeners who don't know, we filed an amicus curiae brief on that topic, which can be found online.
Actually, I would go further. I would recommend that people actually read it, okay? Because there was another amicus brief as well, sort of a collection of individual experiences. But I mean, our brief clearly focused on the problem of the individual, right, in this. But in any case, so I think, I mean, it's always dangerous to predict this stuff. Well, let me ask you this as a question. Do you think it's possible that the Moore decision could come down Now bear in mind, okay, the mores are individuals, the majority of taxpayers impacted by this were individuals, okay. Do you think this decision could come down without any reference to individuals?
I think it's highly likely.
Highly likely.
I'm sure that it will come down without a reference to individuals.
All
I
right.
hope I'm wrong.
I think there's a very good chance of that as well, whether highly likely or sure. But I mean, we agree collectively, I think, that that's a very real possibility. Yes?
Definitely.
Certainly.
So, at the beginning of this thing, I always saw the Moore decision as, well, my view of it, that probably the single most important decision that the Supreme Court's ever really dealt with. Okay, because no matter how you wrap this up, okay, no matter how you package this, if they can do this, they can do anything. There are no limits to taxation, I think. Do you agree with that?
Sure.
Okay, but now let's extend it further. I mean, just when you think it can't get any worse, let's say the Moore decision comes down without any reference to individuals at all. I would interpret that decision to mean, in practical impact, given that the people who were harmed were individuals and the Moors were individuals, that it is a very clear statement from the Supreme Court of the United States that the individual is irrelevant in America. Comments?
Certainly, with
Well,
regard to
I think, I don't think it'd be the first time that you'd see a Supreme Court decision that would at least imply that. So, and that's one of the reasons why I think that kind of just that, this decision that they're going to make probably won't mention individuals. The Treasury the Treasury was asked to alleviate the problems caused by the repatriation tax. And, they were told there are small businesses. Americans are operating small businesses outside the United States, and this is going to be a big problem for them. And the response of the Treasury was to deny that such businesses and such small business owners even existed. I mean, it was express concrete denial of their existence, not even a denial of the effects, but a denial of their existence.
Well, it's much easier to deny the existence than to deny the effects, right? But that's right. That's exactly right. I mean, I remember reading, I presume that, you're discussing the same thing, that, I think it was
Yeah,
something to
I'm
the
sure.
effect that, well, the only people outside the United States who could have CFCs are wealthy people or something of that nature. Wasn't that what it
No,
was?
that all businesses that are operated by Americans outside the United States, by definition, are large multinational companies. By definition, if you're American, you're operating a business outside the United States, by definition, it is not a small business.
Do you realize, by the way, that that completely flatly contradicts Treasury's own 1996 entity classification regulations?
Yeah.
I mean, their lies and ignorance are just simply breathtaking in scope. I mean, it's astounding that they could make a claim like that. By the way, okay, and that, of course, was tied into the whole Regulatory Flexibility Act arguments raised by Marty Silver. I presume you saw that last week. He got, at least, a victory, okay, and that the DC Court of Appeals basically sent his case back to the district court for rehearing on some of these issues. So,
Right.
that was good. That was good. So part of the problem is that, you're involved in a discussion and opposition to a regulatory scheme where there's not even agreement on what the pieces are. Would that make sense?
You're talking about the entire extraterritorial tax system, or
Well, I think partly that, but partly just in the context of this whole CFC issue, right?
yeah, okay.
I mean, it's just craziness, craziness. So let's go back. To the 50s, even go back to the 60s. where or go back 100 years before that. What would Congress's position be on the cost of ending slavery? We can't end slavery unless you can show it's revenue neutral.
This is the problem. When Congress doesn't want to change something, they'll throw out this revenue neutrality argument as a way to get around not having to give the real reasons why they don't want to change it. But this is the problem. When you're talking about fundamental rights of people, you can't say, oh, or at least you shouldn't be doing that. It's fundamentally immoral to say we're not going to end slavery because it wouldn't affect our revenue. But you can
Yeah.
see it happening. You can see it happening it, with an attempt to end slavery within prisons, which it continues to be constitutional today. You could see it, you could or should, at least if people are consistent. There's the now discussion about somehow limiting civil asset forfeiture. Well, surely that would have a huge impact on revenue. I'd like to see if there's anybody discussing, well, I don't know, we can't change this because it has to be revenue neutral. And people would be outraged by that because they'll understand and when it comes to slavery and civil asset forfeiture, they'll inherently understand the rights issues there.
Could you, for the benefit of listeners, Laura, I have discovered over the years that very few people actually know that slavery is constitutionalized in the U.S. With respect to prisoners. Could you elaborate on that and explain that a little bit?
Well, it's the 13th Amendment, whichever amendment it is, basically,
13. Yeah.
and it ends slavery except with respect to people who are prisoners, basically. So if you've been convicted of a crime and you're in a prison, you can be forced to work basically under slave conditions. And that is what happens today in the United States.
Well, exactly. So a company that wants low-cost labor will simply contract with the prison system, right?
Absolutely. It's been happening for, ever since the 13th Amendment was adopted.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing stuff. Are you aware of, I mean, what I find, one of the things I find interesting about this, is that this is actually a constitutional provision, right? I mean,
Yeah, we've
think of it, a constitution, right? Well, effectively, well, it constitutionalizes the legality of slavery in a certain set of circumstances. I mean, you're somewhat of a constitutional scholar, Laura, I think. Are you aware of a constitution in any other country that contains a constitutional provision for slavery?
Well, I'm certainly not a scholar on that level. I am not aware of any such provision, and I would be surprised that any constitution, say, adopted in the past 100 years would have that. I'd be very surprised by that. Certainly not in any modern Western country, but I can't say I've studied it either.
I think that would be an interesting project for SEAT to identify all the countries that constitutionalized slavery. But it's interesting. And I think few people know that. Another thing that I find interesting that people don't know is that American citizens don't have a right to vote, a constitutional right to vote, right? You're aware of that?
John, it's not just that people don't know, it's that they've been actively taught the contrary. When you're in school in the US, you are taught that slavery was ended in the Civil War with the 13th Amendment. You are not taught that there is, and in fact, conditions under which slavery was not ended and in fact is specifically allowed to continue. You are not taught that, not in any real way that you're invited to look at that and reflect on it and think about what that really means. Because that runs counter to the other things that you're meant to believe about the United States, about it being the land of the free. And you're right that there is no right to vote. There are only rules that say that you cannot be prevented from voting for X, Y, and Z reason, but that's not the same thing as giving someone the right to vote.
A constitutional right to vote. There's no constitutional right to vote.
No, there's not.
But you know, a U.S.-based constitutional scholar might say, well, you know, isn't that the beauty of the U.S. Constitution? You know, this is a states' right issue. You know, the way our Constitution works is that, you know, these things are under the control of the states. How can the, you know, how wouldn't a constitutional right to vote disrupt that somehow?
That doesn't make any sense.
No, I know it doesn't make any sense, but would you expect an argument to that effect?
Well, usually the argument that something is meant to be states' rights is usually the first step in actually denying that right.
Yeah, true.
Right. Well, there is no constitutional right to vote. Okay. Do you think that, generally speaking, the American public knows there's no constitutional right to vote? Yeah.
I don't think they care that much. I think there's a lot of Americans who think that there are a lot of people who should not have the right to vote.
You think Americans abroad should have the right to vote? In American
Well,
elections, I mean.
I think you and I disagree on this, but of course Americans should have the right to vote. Americans who live overseas should have the right to vote. But I think you and I disagree on that, John.
I think we disagree on that profoundly, yes. So you think it's okay for DA to get you know, bus voters into places like Arizona and Georgia?
That's not the same question. How DA goes about soliciting votes from overseas voters is different from whether or not they should have the right to vote.
Do you think an American citizen never lived in the United States should be able to vote in a US election?
Well, yes, I do. They are affected by the laws the United States adopts, so they should have a voice in how those laws are come about. Absolutely.
Okay, all right.
And I would even go further, and I realize this is pretty radical, but given the position the United States has in the world and how it affects everybody in the world, its disproportionate power in the world, everybody should have the right to vote in American elections. Everybody suffers under the decisions that are made by people in the United States. Everybody should have a right to how those decisions, to have some input in how those decisions are made.
Well, listen, I don't think you get very far with that argument, but here I have a compromise. What about giving every American abroad the equivalent of 10 votes instead of just one? What would you think about that? Not only do they have the right to vote, but the vote of any American abroad is worth 10 times the vote of any resident American. What do you think?
I don't know what to tell you that, John. I don't think you get very
I
far
want to
with that.
know, do you think that's a good idea?
No. I think if you're being honest, it's one person, one vote. But you could say, given how much influence money has, money already has a disproportionate power, voting power, and it's not right.
All right. So, should Americans abroad be required to buy their freedom?
No, they should not.
No, and they already are because you have to buy a certificate of loss of nationality.
That's
And
right.
pay the exit tax.
Renunciation is free, but the piece of paper costs $23.50.
That's right.
Do you think of that fee anyway? $2,350.
I think it's excessive. And
I
I think
think,
they're really dragging their feet on cutting it back to 450, which is still high, but not outrageous.
well, you
It's been
know,
over a year. It's been over a year since they said they were going to cut it, and they haven't cut it.
yep.
Go
That
ahead, John.
is, well, you know, it took them 10 years to put a man on the moon, right? I mean, this is something of it's complexity cutting this fee, right? I mean, maybe it's reasonable to take a few
How
years,
long did it take
but
them to raise it from 450 to 2350 when they decided to do that?
well,
90-day public comment period, right?
did they have a comment period?
I think they did. They put the 450 out for public comment,
Well,
I
maybe that
think.
just didn't have the degree of complexity. I mean, clearly there's a revenue loss to the United States in lowering the fee, right? Maybe that requires more complex analysis. What do you think?
Well, the thing is, what's interesting about that is the paper that we're talking about, number 14 in the Working Paper Series, it addresses a proposal for changing the system. I would not definitely not call it a proposal for RBT. And this proposal purports to be revenue neutral. One of the important ways that it brings this about is by basically saying that, okay, if you want to remove yourself from the US tax system, you need a departure certificate. And isn't that funny? We're going to charge $2,350 for that departure certificate, which is exactly the same amount you would pay today to renounce US citizenship. And that just that proposal makes a mockery of what the State Department has said about why the fee is what it is. Because the State Department has said, oh, this fee actually corresponds to our costs. Well, if you're going to take that exact same fee and apply it to a departure certificate, then you've just, you're saying that the departure certificate has the exact same cost? How do you know that? Show us that. The chances of that being the case are pretty slim. So the whole thing is just crazy. And people are gaslighting right and left.
Well, I think the point of that proposal is that either way you pay, right?
Yes, either way you pay, because you can't make somebody else pay. You can't, if you're going to change the way you tax overseas Americans, and if your prediction is that this is going to result in some sort of lower revenue, then the only way to compensate for that revenue is to tax overseas Americans in some different way. So either way, they're going to pay. And you've solved no one's problem.
I think that's very, very clear, right? But the other aspect of that particular proposal was that I think it retained CBT, didn't it?
Well, you still had to register every year to say, yeah, I still qualify.
Yeah.
Well, as I've said a million times, you one does not leave the land of the free for free. Absolutely not.
So they're going to reduce the fee from 2350 to 450, and everybody knows they're going to reduce it. Has that slowed down the demand for renunciation services? I mean, I hear that in places there are huge waiting lists still. People are still waiting 12 months to get an appointment.
You know what I
And
find
then there's
on that? I have a group of people I'm working with. I mean, I don't mean they're related, okay, but who started the process about 8 months ago and are now getting appointments, even in places like Toronto, which has been almost unheard of, for the last decade. So, I mean, I think it's a little early to, draw any conclusion there, but it does seem to me that, there isn't sort of the blockage that there was. I think
And once they drop it to 450, that'll be a big tsunami of people who have been waiting for the fee to go down since they've known for a year that it's going to go down.
that'll be interesting to see. I'm not actually convinced that is the case. But maybe it's a really, really interesting thing because, whether you pay 450, whether you pay 2350, the price you pay, although it may be out of proportion to the cost, the price you pay, it's very, very undervalued relative to the benefit of it. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, my God, for most people, renouncing U.S. citizenship is, if we look at this in monetary terms, is the single biggest investment anybody can make, to get out of this system, right? It's incredible. But you think that there's a bunch of people who are just waiting for the fee to get down to
I
four.
think there are a certain class of people who are doing that. And then there are others who are looking at it saying, I just have to get out now. I don't care what it costs.
What do you think on that, Laura?
I think Karen's probably right. It's hard to know for sure, but that's kind of my feeling.
Well, I can tell you that I have and continue to observe lots of people of very modest means who are aware that the fee is supposed to go down and are jumping on the opportunity to renounce at the 2350 anyway. So it's interesting. I mean, these are people where, that $2,000 is significant. I mean, it's like the difference between a family vacation and not, right? So, I mean, that tells you something, I think, doesn't it?
Well, but I do hear from occasionally from people who say, has it gone down yet? I'm just waiting for it to go down.
I would think some people who are kind of still on the fence or psychologically not totally sure what they want to do, this news that it's supposed to go down could be, tip the balance. When they're undecided, that could tip the balance in terms to make them say, okay, I'll just wait.
Well, yeah, it becomes of a way of expressing their own indecisiveness on the issue. And by the way, to be clear, there's a lot of indecisiveness on this. And what you know I've I you may or may not know. I mean, I'm not. For younger people, I don't think they should renounce if they can hang on, right? I mean, I think that, there is going to be change down the road. It's just a question of when. But a lot of people, I find sort of, people beginning careers and that are very, very torn on the issue of renunciation, very torn. And, it's the kind of thing where I don't think that people going in and renouncing, very few of them are, like 100%, I have absolutely, zero regrets, et cetera. It really just reflects a decision where they just don't believe they can comply with the rules, That, the rules are just so destructive that even while recognizing that US citizenship has value, they realize they just cannot have the kind of life and the opportunity that they want if they remain American citizens.
Well, I would think if you're talking about young people, what I remember from the surveys is people want not wanting to get married because of this. That's where I could see.
Well, how do they express that? They don't want to get married because of it.
They don't want to saddle their spouse with the issues, basically.
I mean, are they really saddling their spouse with the issues? I mean, there's a contrary way.
That's the way they see it. I'm just saying that's the way they see it. Where they see it and what the reality is aren't necessarily the same thing.
No, I think that's right, but it's interesting that they do see it that way. I mean, I think that there's some truth in that under certain circumstances. On the other hand, it does open the opportunity, for a tax-free capital gain on a principal residence, right? If the U.S. citizen doesn't hold title. So, I mean, this stuff is complicated. It's complicated. But I think that because of the complexity, I think people are renouncing because of the complexity and because of the inability, to really think these things through, sort of rationally, right? I mean, how can they? I mean, I mean, I think we all agree the learning curve on this stuff is years, years. You can't expect somebody, just going online or, participating in a few discussion groups to be able to evaluate this stuff.
Yeah.
But, it sure is an example of, there's that old saying, the power to tax is the power to destroy. I mean, the United States has. I mean, the kindest thing you could say is that it is very, very significantly diminished, if not destroyed, the value of US citizenship through these policies, right?
Yeah, that is something that Chief Justice Marshall said. How many? I mean, gosh, how long ago was Chief Justice Marshall? Was it probably, I don't know, 17 something, 18 something? But he said that, and I can't remember which opinion. He said the power to tax is the power to destroy. And I mean, that's what we've been talking about, that these laws destroy citizenship. That's the same. They destroy people's lives, but they destroy citizenship.
And they create, interestingly, a caste system of citizenship. Because, we have citizenship taxation. But we also have, when you look at the exemption of the exit tax rules, citizenship non-taxation, right? So, we have this incredibly obscene situation where the circumstances of your birth go a very long way in determining the outcome of your life. That's what American citizenship really stands for. I think more than anything else. I mean, imagine a situation where, you have two people born in the same town on the same day. One of them is born to a Canadian citizen father. Who, by the way, might have never even lived in Canada. The other is a direct descendant of the Daughters of the American Revolution. They grow up, they have similar successes. The one who was born of the Canadian citizen father has the opportunity to completely escape the exit tax. If they want to renounce US citizenship. It's not automatic, okay, but the pillars are in place to do that. The one who was born is only an American citizen, has no chance, right? So, it's almost as though it's a caste system of citizenship, right? Where because of the tax laws, those who are born with dual citizenship are essentially a preferred status of citizen with greater opportunities. What am I missing?
Well, those who aren't citizens at all, you could argue from an investment perspective, have the greatest amount of rights.
Yeah, oh,
Interesting.
absolutely. I mean, it's very interesting. Very interesting question, of what citizenship even is, right? And I mean, there's a lot of like just fascinating discussion on this. I mean, there's a book out recently. I can't remember the man's name. He's a very well-known professor called Citizenship Apartheid, where, if you're not born, say, with, first world citizenship, you're disabled for life. And I mean, citizenship matters, although it's hard to know what it even is, right? I mean, is citizenship for most people anything other than an accident of birth?
Yeah.
Good
Yeah.
question.
Anyway, above my pay grade, maybe not above yours, Laura, so maybe you can write a paper on that. But cat.
Getting into bigger questions than taxes, John, with that one.
Oh, it's funny.
You're starting to talk about borders, should we have borders, et cetera. So that's another realm.
Laura, I'm just trying to keep you busy for the next year or two, okay? Get another
Or
You know,
ten.
collection of papers, yeah. Well, in any case, revenue neutrality. Bottom line, how
It's an
about should not
excuse.
be
It's an
relevant?
ex. It
Is
should
it?
be. It's yes. It's an excuse. It's nothing more than an excuse to not do what needs to be done.
Sort of like, you asked somebody out for a date. Sorry, I'm doing my laundry that night.
Yeah.
That's sort of the equivalent, isn't it? I mean, it's so absurd. It's so absurd. I mean, what it tells you is that in the American legislative process, if anything, if things are tied to revenue neutrality, there can be no concept of morality at all, can there?
That's the problem.
Yep, that's the point.
Yeah. Well, okay. Any other thoughts on this particularly? By the way, what's your prediction in the Moore case? Laura?
Oh, I the only thing I'm willing to predict is that individuals will be irrelevant to the decision. That's the only thing
Yeah.
I don't know. For the rest, I really don't.
So you realize that that's the main significance of the decision, right? Supreme Court will serve notice that in America, individuals don't matter.
Yet another way that they will, but yes.
What do you think, Karen? What happened to Moore?
Yeah, I'm having trouble reading those tea leaves, John.
Well, Laura was in the courtroom. So, Laura, why don't we go through all the justices and you tell me which way you think they're going to vote?
Oh, John.
I think it'll be fun.
John, to be honest, I honestly, the only thing I'm willing, I really don't know, but the only thing I'm willing to predict is that individuals will be irrelevant to the decision.
That's the
That's
only
really
thing
the
you're
only.
willing to predict. So if I were to ask you, how do you think Justice Sotomayor will vote on this? You would say you don't know.
No, I don't.
Interesting. All right. All right. Well, this has been an interesting discussion this morning. Somewhat depressing. You think?
I but it's this issue is very frustrating for me because I think it's the biggest. One of the biggest impediments to getting change is also the one of the things that people understand the least and are really least willing to educate themselves on. For example, this particular paper is one of the least downloaded, which means it's people have the least amount of interest in this topic.
That is truly disgusting, isn't it? Laura, do you think that you have a do you think French citizens living in France, do you think they have there's a higher standard of individual rights protection than in the United States?
I think that would depend on different factors. I mean, there's the rights aren't exactly the same in France. You're definitely seeing, for example, well, you're definitely seeing in Germany that there's some restrictions on people's speech rights that I don't think you would see in the United States. I think it would depend on a lot of different factors, John. I don't know that I could make a generalization.
What do you think, Karen, in Australia? Do you, what is your sense? Do you think that Australian residents are generally afforded a higher standard of individual rights?
I think I'd have to agree with Laura. It really depends on the area that you're talking about. The Australian government can be quite paternalistic in a lot of ways, and that does limit individual rights. There is no Bill of Rights or anything similar in the Australian Constitution.
Well, there isn't in the British Constitution either. I mean, I think it's very, very clear that having a constitutional Bill of Rights or whatever you want to call this stuff is no guarantee of actually having the rights.
True.
That's for sure. Yeah, very interesting.
I mean, you're looking at countries that are all colonizers. And I don't think any country that's a colonizer is one that you would say respects human rights.
Yeah, I think that clearly that is the case. Clearly that is the case. No doubt about it. Well, it occurs to me that we're living in a time when individual rights are kind of under attack, do you think?
Certainly, to some extent, they are.
Laura, do you feel your rights are under attack? Okay, so let's call it a day then. Karen, final thoughts, any?
I think we've covered it basically. The current system violates people's rights, and therefore they shouldn't have to pay to have that violation of their rights cease. So revenue neutrality shouldn't even be an issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Laura would say, you seem to have lost her here, but I think that Laura would probably say, I don't want to put words in her mouth, that if you have to pay for the right, then the right doesn't exist, right?
Exactly.
Sorry, I was on mute there. I apologize.
Yeah.
John, I do think that my rights are being violated. And clearly, if you have to pay to have, if your rights are being violated and you have to pay to have that stop, you don't have that right. That's what I'm trying to say in these papers. If you insist on revenue neutrality to change these laws, you are basically denying that these rights violations are occurring.
Exactly.
You do not
Perfect.
insist. You do not insist on revenue neutrality to end slavery. You do not insist on revenue neutrality to end racial discrimination. You do not insist on revenue neutrality to end civil asset forfeiture. And you do not insist on revenue neutrality to end the system that discriminates on the basis of nationality, that causes the forcible destruction of citizenship. It's absurd. And the accepting the premise, just by accepting the premise, you've lost. And all of these proposals that are out there right now, all of them, there's two to my knowledge, these proposals that are out there to end this system, both are predicated on revenue neutrality, which means that they deny that there are any rights violations. And that's the bottom line of all of this.
Laura, I think that's very, very well put. I do agree with you completely on that. More generally, though, that this needs to be a warning for future litigants, advocacy groups, etc., that it's very, very important to set the terms of the discussion early on, right? Because there's a saying in politics, define or be defined, and this acceptance of revenue neutrality, or even allowing it into the conversation, is so completely idiotic, is really providing governments with the opportunity to, for plausible denial, right? Plausible denial of the right or whatever. So, very, very good points. Very good points. And I think we've pretty much covered it today. Great discussion. I thank you both very much for it. And Laura, I thank you very much for this series of papers generally, and for this one, of course, specifically.
Thank you, John. Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, both of you.